set for this afternoon, and that is the case of People Against Michael Lacefield. We have experienced counsel. It's great to see you both. Mr. Mueller.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And may it please the court, I'm Norman Mueller. I represent Michael Lacefield. Two of the four issues presented in this case are issues that are problematic and recurring in cases involving charges of sexual assault on a child. And I'm speaking about the unanimity issue and, in this case, also the hearsay statements that were allowed into evidence without any of the statutory procedures having been followed. Let me address first the unanimity issue. In this case, the case was started out correctly to address this issue, and that was when the defense lawyer asked for a bill of particulars. In the bill of particulars, the prosecution delineated three specific sexual types of activity to support the four charges that the jury ultimately heard. But then that was the end of it. The jury was never informed in any fashion whatsoever what specific acts related to which particular charge. The prosecution was never required to elect or further specify at the end of the evidence, which presented by my count in some rather confusing testimony, since we had so many hearsay statements admitted, at least nine different types of sexual activity. And crucially, the jury was never told that they must find and agree unanimously that Mr. Lacefield either committed all of the acts, or that the jury must agree that as to which particular act Mr. Lacefield committed. In Colorado, we started out in Astorga with the courts requiring essentially election. There had to be an election of a specific incident before these kind of charges could go to the jury. And over time, given the problems that arise with young children making these allegations, our Supreme Court and this court have said, well, there's an alternative to that. We may not be able to specify by time, by date, but the prosecution, once the evidence is presented, either has to elect which type of sexual activity is to be presented to the jury, or alternatively, the jury must be told, and the language is shall, the jury shall be told that they must agree which act, they must all agree that the defendant committed a particular act, or alternatively that the defendant committed all of those acts. That did not happen in this case. Judge Russell.
What are we to draw from the fact that apparently defense counsel did not request an election?
Well, I could say some things about the way this case was tried on all levels. This was a case in front of a very new trial judge, first of all. And this was a case that I can only say both counsel appeared not to be on top of the law or the legal issues in these type of cases, by the way the case was tried. What, in specific answer to your question, it means that this is a plain error review, because defense counsel did not go beyond his initial request for bill of particulars, did not assure that, for instance, the verdict forms reflected a particular type of activity that related to count one, count two, count three, and count four. And remember, the prosecution, I will say this, defense counsel at least objected to the bill of particulars as saying this isn't quite specific enough, and there were two overlapping descriptions. In two of the counts, they're identical in the bill of particulars even. So
it's your view that after receiving the bill of particulars, counsel would not be apprised of even then which incidents we're relying on, or the prosecution was relying on?
Counsel was apprised, and this is not an issue with regard to counsel's lack of preparation. What we're talking about is, was defendant denied his right to a unanimous jury verdict because the jury didn't know what defense counsel knew and was never informed?
How was counsel apprised apart from the bill of particulars?
he wasn't.
Okay, so in your view anyway, those would be possibly sufficient to apprise counsel?
Possibly sufficient to apprise counsel. I mean, I would have done a lot more. But at least counsel knew that the allegations that would go to the jury if it had been done right were these three specific sexual acts that were described in for the four counts. Now, there are problems with that because we have a pattern instruction, we have overlapping identical, well, we have identical underlying counts that are charged, but the issue really boils down to was the jury ever told, did the jury ever understand they had to agree as to that particular count, as that particular activity, or that the defendant committed all of the activity?
Mr. Meehl, let me ask you, I think what you'll probably see is a loaded question, but as it was tried, was this really an all or nothing case?
Well, I think it was, as are, quite frankly, most of these cases. And I think where I want to go with that, Judge Connolly, is to compare the plain error cases. Both are quite old. And I think that should tell the court something, and that is most counsel and most trial judges, this issue has been around a while, and we should be able to do this correctly.
Now, let's assume this was obvious error that everybody should have known about. I guess I'm asking you to home in on the prejudice inquiry, that it was a fundamental miscarriage.
Well, it was a fundamental miscarriage of justice in this case, because we had numerous acts of sexual activity alleged by a 12-year-old claiming to remember things from when she was 2, almost 3, to almost 4 years of age, never before alleged, until 8-9 years later, makes a claim not spontaneously, but sort of after some questioning by a grandmother who admittedly, if you read her testimony, is certainly a motivated witness and has an agenda of her own. And it is like the Wortman case in the sense that in Wortman, there was no defensive alibi. There was no defensive misidentification. There were multiple sexual acts. 3 counts went to the jury. The jury was never told that they had to agree what specific act related to what specific charge, or that they had to agree as to what act was committed. And Justice Erickson wrote, when you have multiple allegations of sexual activity, and there is the possibility that jurors could disagree, because in this case you have the accuser saying certain things at trial and then denying that she had said certain rather, you know, graphic things just a few months earlier in response to a forensic interview.
Except wasn't Wortman was a 404B case of 50, there were basically 50 uncharged acts, and here wouldn't every act that was testified to at least be relevant to the pattern itself? It would be part of the crime charge as opposed to 404B, wouldn't it?
Well, it could be relevant, but I submit that they were also, quote, similars. I mean, we've progressed over time where, I guess I'll call it progression, but I'm not sure, I'm so sure I agree with that, but where almost all of these, the evidence of all of this kind of similar activity comes in. And sure, there were more in Wortman. But if you compare Roeckler, Roeckler is the only case I could find which the court has held there was not plain error when there was neither the specification slash election or the unanimity instruction that the court in Thomas said we had to use. And that was a case when there, by the time it went to the jury, it was narrowed to a 1-month period of time and one incident. And when there is one event, one incident, that's when the court can say, okay, we don't think there's any reasonable likelihood that the jury could have disagreed. That is not this case, because we have an accuser saying 2 or 3 things happened when she testified on direct, yet having told rather graphically different things over a course of time, and having been subjected to, I think would agree, was a long period of questioning by her grandmother.
Mr. Mueller, what about Thomas itself? In that case, there were a number of incidents, but there was no unanimity instruction. Of course, that's the case out of which the requirement arose. And the court nevertheless found that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in that case, because even though there were a number of incidents that were testified to, it was an all or nothing case, and there was no possibility that the judge or that the jury might have believed the victim as to some acts and not others. Why is that case different from this case?
Well, my recollection of Thomas is the great distinction is that in Thomas, the jury was told in a verdict form or an instruction what specific act related to which particular count. That's my recollection of Thomas. And so that, and that really gets to what is really a third way, which is never, I don't think a court has said this is the alternative way that you should do it. The court has said election, and if you're not going to elect, you need the unanimity instruction. But the court has said, and Thomas was a case, where if there is this other sort of specification, and the cases I've tried, that's what we've done. We have insisted, and the trial judges have agreed, that when that verdict form is specified, count one, this is the touching incident at the computer, or this is, if you can't get it that specific, this is fondling, or this is penetration, or this is oral sexual contact. And so at least the jury is focused, and then if you don't have the unanimity instruction, which you should give, and which the trial judge and counsel should have known you were supposed to give, at least you still have some facts that can, that you know that the jury is looking at a particular allegation when they're rendering a particular verdict. And I think those are the two distinctions in Thomas. Let me quickly turn to the hearsay statements. And again, we have a situation where we have a combination of no pretrial hearing as to the reliability of all these hearsay statements that came in, and we don't have the instruction that tells the jury you have to give special care to evaluating these hearsay statements. And again, we have a situation where the legislature passed the law that allowed in the hearsay statements. Our courts have said this is in derogation of common law. We have to interpret it strictly in favor of the defendant. And to avoid the undue prejudice, it is required. That's why the statute says shall. It is required that we give this instruction. And McClure is a case. It was the previous statute, which required both contemporaneous and at the end of the evidence instruction. But in McClure, the Supreme Court said it is plain error not to give this instruction. Well, we have more in this case because we have all of this hearsay flowing in without any hearing or determination of whether these statements are reliable. And if I had more time, I would go through the nine factors in the statute, and all of them are implicated in the facts of this case. None of them were developed. We have no findings of fact, but all are implicated, from the fact that it wasn't spontaneous to the fact that it was in response to questions from the grandmother, to the fact that there was a bias and motive to lie because the young girl admitted that that she wanted Mr. Lacefield to go to jail and that she knew her grandmother wanted him to go to jail, to the fact that there was what was called negative stereotyping. Both grandparents testified that Mr. Lacefield was a liar. Yes, we have a dysfunctional grandchild who's kind of manipulative herself, but she learned it from her stepfather, who was a liar. So all of these factors are implicated. This is a case that cries out for a lengthy and careful evidentiary hearing as to which of these statements should come in, and none of that was done. And this is a case where we had five people talking about the hearsay statements of this witness, just the number of people I think we had in McClure. And it's for this
defense witness, though.
One was a defense witness after the police officer testified as to her statements in double hearsay, which also wasn't objected to. There are other reasons this case should be reversed, but this is a case that has all the red flags of a wrongful conviction, and without these protections, I think it's very likely in this case, and that's why Mr. Lacefield needs a new trial.
Ms. Ritz.
Well, Wendy Ritz, representing the people in this matter. The defendant starts out with the unanimity issue. And initially, I'd like to note, as I do in my brief, that it can be argued that there was certainly a strategic reason not to further specify dates, times, events, in order to get exactly what the defendant got here, out from under the Colorado Sex Offender Lifetime Supervision Act.
Isn't that just speculation on our part, though? I mean, invited error normally is something where you know, the defendant asked for something. We're not speculating. We see the record, and we know what happened. Here, I think we're asking us to read a mind of a defense counsel.
Well, I would urge the court to consider Justice Coates' concurrence in the Molina case, where he suggests if you don't either elect or if you don't make the choice to ask for the election or the instruction, you've basically waived this, because you are entitled to get it if you want it, but if you don't ask for it, you've waived it. I would urge the court to consider that. Clearly, it's only concurrence, so it's not really binding authority. And I would suggest that the invited error approach has some merit here. I think if you read the sentencing memorandum they filed with the court, it's basically, there was no interrogatory, there was no request for specificity, and now this is what we should get. I think it's not a stretch to find that there was certainly a strategic reason to do this.
Well, if they were instructed in the terms of the bill of particulars, that wouldn't preclude the argument anyway, because that was not done in terms of act, it was done in terms of type of incident. There would be no dating of those acts, I'm not sure the strategy for that at least requiring some specification.
Yeah, I understand it. It's a bit of a reach here, but I do think it's something the court should be thinking about in looking at the plain error, totality of the circumstances approach to all the issues we have before us. Essentially, pretty much everything presented to you is plain error. And I think you need to look at what was the defense thinking and doing. And I think these are reasonable and proper things for the court to take into account, that there were probably strategic reasons they did a lot of what they did. As we know, when evidence of many acts exists, any of which could constitute the offense charge, the people may be compelled to elect, or special modified unanimity instruction should be given. And neither of those was done here, although there was no request. The requirement of the modified unanimity instruction is there to ensure that the jurors agree on the acts. And here, I think we can find it harmless because there's no reasonable likelihood that they would have disagreed. I think if you look at the core of the victim's testimony, which I think the trial court summarized in denying the defense motion for judgment of acquittal, she talked about the incidents with the belly button rocking back and forth, the touching of the penis at the vagina, and the tracing of the vagina with her fingers. Those core events were consistent throughout all her statements, throughout her trial testimony, other things she denied in her trial testimony, but the core was there. And I think this is essentially a case, if you look at the defense theory, that this girl was making this up and lying. It was really essentially an all or nothing case. And I think it's pretty much of a stretch to figure out, well, we probably would have believed this, but we wouldn't have believed that. It seems to me that given the central features that the defense expert talked about, were consistent throughout. Her testimony was consistent with that, and it's clear, I think, what the jury relied upon to convict.
Sure. Given the way that this case was instructed and tried, and given the arguments of counsel, in your view, would it have been clear to the jurors which four incidents were being relied on for prosecution in this case? How is it that the jury really knew which was event one and which was event two?
I don't know if there's any way that they were clear on what was event one and event two, but in a sense, it's similar to the Quintano case, where we also had sort of five unspecified counts, and there we also there was found to be harmless error in the way it was presented. So I think the fact that it was not numbered does not prevent us from trusting that the jury, in reaching each unanimous verdict, they understood they had to reach a unanimous verdict on each count, that as to each count, they decided, okay, this count, however they did it, we can trust that they unanimously came to a verdict on each count, and that it related to the core testimony that was presented by the victim.
Well, let me follow up if I can. We can trust they entered a unanimous verdict, but how do we know that, let's say, counts 2, 3, and 4, that they weren't simply the same count, the same crime charged three different times? How do we know it's not a double jeopardy violation?
You know, that's also presented in Quintana and Wolhoff, and it's significant here that the defendant received concurrent sentences, and I think that was the remedy in Wolhoff, is that essentially it was merged down into one. I think if double jeopardy is the concern, that's a different question than, that's more of a sentencing concern than the unanimity.
Well,
and
the defendant also cites Wolhoff and says that they may have been, how do we know it's a different unit of prosecution? I mean, reading the face of the information, it's all the jury had, or the, you know, the descriptions and the same date and undifferentiated act, they could have convicted three times for the same offense, couldn't they? Or four times?
It's possible, although I think Quintana presents the same concerns, and this court found there that given the concurrent sentences and given the evidence presented, this court was able to uphold.
Was it not clear in Quintana that there were four discrete events? Maybe we didn't know which one was which.
Yeah, I don't think we knew what count related to what.
But it was clear that there were at least four incidents. There were.
From my memory of Quintana, I think so. Although there might have been some peripheral other sexual contact, as in this case, with maybe something horseplay at the pool or something like that. So there might have been some other peripheral stuff going on, as there was here. So I haven't looked at it for a while, so I don't want to lead you astray as to that. The defense theory of the case here was not something like alibi or something where they picked out specific dates or acts. This was something where essentially from the beginning of the case, the defense theory was this little girl is a chronic liar. In fact, I think they said that in an opening statement and in closing argument. Their whole theory of the case was that she made this all up. It was really essentially an all or nothing thing. And as I think the Hansen analysis makes clear, in cases like this, this is really the case where we can find that there's no reasonable likelihood of disagreement because the jurors either believed the child or they didn't believe the child. And that's what we have here.
What about the relationship between the child's testimony and the hearsay statements that were brought in? Is it possible that the jury would have found potentially one more believable than the other given the convergence of the two types of evidence on the same point?
It's possible, but I think given her testimony, which related to these sort of central features that the defense expert liked to talk about, those features were consistent throughout, and I think were consistent throughout all her hearsay statements. So I'm not sure that there's a great prejudicial effect coming in from this, from the fact that we had the hearsay. In fact, I guess turning briefly to the hearsay argument, a position that I argued briefly in a footnote, I would like to suggest here, is that no matter what the problems are with the child hearsay issues, I think that this evidence hearsay or the child statements properly could come in as non-hearsay, as prior consistent statements. If you look at the way this case was tried from the outset, the victim's credibility was vigorously attacked by the defense. She was the first witness. Opening statement was, this child is a chronic liar. She's vigorously cross-examined. Her credibility is called into question. She's, at that point, I think the hearsay statements were properly admitted, as the prosecutor pointed out, as prior consistent statements under 801.
But don't they have to be, for that exception, don't they have to be made at a time before the motive to fabricate would have existed? They were made when she was 10 years old, I guess, at the time when they're arguably, or the defense theory would be that there's some reason to implicate him so she could stay with the grandparents, I guess. So wouldn't that be the same motive at the time they were made as at the time of trial?
I'm not certain of that. I think the defense suggested that there was kind of an evolving tainting and evolving motive and influence from the grandparents, from the suggestive interviewing. It seems to me that their theory did suggest that there was sort of this rolling, evolving, continuing suggestiveness and taint. And I think given that strong, vigorous credibility attack, I think that that makes it these statements permissibly presented as prior consistent.
Would they come in as full substantive evidence under that exception?
They would be non-hearsay under 801, let me find the rule, 801D, where is it? I think it's D1B. They're considered non-hearsay, essentially. It's slightly different than, I think, 16-201. I think those statutes deal with the similar stuff, but under this, it's presented as non-hearsay and comes in as substantive evidence.
And the trial court, that was argued to the trial court, and the trial court, as I recall, rejected that, didn't it?
I think the court said, I'll let it in under 1325-129. I don't think the court explicitly rejected it, but I think this court can certainly uphold the conviction on any basis that could have been used by the trial court. And addressing the child hearsay 1325-129 claim, I think it's significant that prior to trial, there was a hearing assessing the reliability of Cheryl Young's expert testimony. And her expert testimony related to the validity of the child's statements. She had done a forensic report and analysis of the child's hearsay statements. So the court was essentially presented with a whole similar analysis as would have happened in a 1325-129 hearing and had the information before it to make reliability determinations. And in fact, I think given the testimony at that hearing and the court's rulings, it might be why no one at that point further questioned the reliability. Admittedly, it would have been better if they had done the hearing, but I think it can be considered harmless. And I think the Bowers case makes clear that when we're reviewing this for plain error, we can look at the entire transcript and look at how the testimony came out and the reliability and that sort of thing to find that it is harmless error. Similarly, as to the limiting instruction, again, the defense did not request it. And the regular limiting instruction was given, or the regular witness credibility instruction was given, which at length talks about the factors that are to be weighed and considered. They were also instructed that they're to consider an expert's testimony as any other witness. And I think the case law suggests that that can also be harmless error. If the court has no further questions, I would ask the court to affirm the defendant's convictions.
Thank you. I think you have a few seconds, Mr. Mueller.
I would make a couple points. First, with regard to Quintano, I think you're right, Judge Russell, in your recollection. My recollection as well is that there was a unanimity instruction given in Quintano. And again, that's what we did not have here. And with regard to Bowers on the hearsay issues, my recollection is the criticism in Bowers was the lack of specific findings. There nevertheless was a hearing on the reliability of the hearsay statements. We ask that Mr. Lacefield's conviction be reversed.
Thank you. That concludes our argument for this afternoon. The court thanks both counsel for their excellent arguments, both today and in your briefs. Really first-rate work. Thank you. There being no further business, this case will be considered at issue, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Bailiff may announce a recess.
All rise. The court will be in recess, subject to call.